from deep inside your radio.
Oh, so much stuff piled, spewed out of the printer today. So much important stuff. The battle for hearts and minds goes on, ladies and gentlemen. U.S. pilots and ground commanders failed to follow proper procedures during a major battle in early May in western Afghanistan, resulting in airstrikes that killed at least 26 Afghan civilians. That's according to a report released by the U.S. military. The long-awaited document calls for changes in the instruction and training of pilots and ground commanders. Never too late to win hearts and minds. The military report says it's impossible, quote, conclusively to determine the number of civilian casualties that occurred on May 4th, 2009. Making friends wherever we go. And says the number could be far higher. A report on the same incident by the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission concluded there were as many as 86 civilian casualties. Local Afghan officials put the total at 140. But, you know, at $80 a head, it's not really that big. Civilian casualties from U.S. airstrikes have provoked widespread anger in Afghanistan in recent years. Why wouldn't they? You might well ask. And in the accountability department, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Michael Mullen, said this week there was no reason to pursue disciplinary action against any of the soldiers, Marines, or pilots involved in the battle. So that's the way you deal with failing to follow proper procedures during a major battle and killing civilians is, hey, go ahead on with your bad self. Ladies and gentlemen, on another subject, the joy, and I speak as a former, sometime, still sometime recording artist, the joy of working for major record labels is too ecstatic just to limit to musicians. It's now been spread to universities. They're working for the record companies. After President Bush signed into the law the Higher Education Opportunity Act last year, universities realized it included several new provisions, including a new requirement that schools ensure they are doing all they can to combat illegal file sharing among students. The new rules require institutions to develop plans to effectively combat the unauthorized distribution of copyrighted material, including through the use of a variety of technology-based deterrents. Schools must also, to the extent practicable, offer alternatives to illegal downloading. Any institution found to be noncompliant can lose federal funding. File sharing has never been a problem at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. We have not received one complaint about one student, says David Reese, head of IT security at that university, yet we have to go out and incur the cost to solve a problem that we didn't really have. Reese estimates he will spend approximately $100,000 implementing new hardware and software in order to be in compliance with the regulation. But figuring out exactly what's needed is not easy because the rulemaking process is still going on, so the exact language interpretation from the Department of Education is still forthcoming. That's what life is like, ladies and gentlemen, when you're working for the major record companies. The tentative books are closed on the Beijing Olympics. They say they made a profit. $2.8 billion was spent on organizing and staging the games, and income of $3 billion, leaving a profit of $176 million. The biggest chunk, 40%, came from broadcasting and marketing rights, along with sales of tickets. Now, these are only operating expenses, leaving out spending on venues and infrastructure. Oh, well, I see. Easy to get a profit that way, if you don't count building the venues and the roads to the venues. And by the way, speaking of the venues, the famous Bird's Nest Stadium, less than a year after fans packed in for the striking opening and closing ceremonies, the Bird's Nest Stadium has yet to host another sports event and sits almost entirely vacant, except for some tourists. Hey, Chicago, want some Olympics? Hello, welcome to the show.
Here it is!
From deep in...
Well, we did that, too. Let's do something we haven't done.
you back from the dead. So it is said, we're back from the grave.
Recovered from a coma, more body than a Roman.
It's life that we crave. Watch our hearts pump as we go back into action.
Go!
Giving satisfaction and getting some too. Hear our blood roar as we roll a lucky seven.
From hell,
oh, from heaven. We're past, but we're due. When the blood-red moon peeps over the naked hills, when the nightshade blooms beside the rocky road to daylight's end, and the spirits re-inhabit their castaway bodies of yore,
don't say I didn't warn you.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. The companies that own almost half the nation's nuclear reactors are or are not setting aside enough money to dismantle them safely. Hands are not, is the answer. Many may sit idle for decades and pose safety and security risks as a result, according to an investigation by the Associated Press. Since when is the Associated... Well, since recently. The shortfalls are caused not by fluctuating appetites for nuclear power, but by the stock market and other investments, which have suffered huge losses over the past year and devastated the plant savings, and by the soaring cost of decommissioning. It's too cheap to meter, but it's too expensive to dismantle. How does that happen? At 19 nuclear plants, owners have won approval to idle reactors for as long as 60 years, presumably enough time to allow investments to recover, and eventually to pay for dismantling the plants and removing the old radioactive material, which meantime just sits there glowing quietly. Mothballing nuclear reactors or shutting them down inadequately presents the most severe of risks, says the AP. Radioactive waste could leak from abandoned plants into groundwater or release into the air, and spent nuclear fuel rods could be stolen by terrorists. Estimates of dismantling costs have soared by more than $4.6 billion because of rising energy and labor costs. Well, nobody could have predicted that. While the investment funds are supposed to pay for shutting plants down have lost $4.4 billion in the stock market. It's the magic of the marketplace. It's your problem. The power companies have been hammered by the same declining market returns as colleges, companies, and private investors. Industry critics say reactor owners weren't saving enough even before the financial collapse, and federal regulators have not held the industry to a high enough standard, they say. Federal regulators are expected to release a report that will describe shortfalls at 30 of the nation's 104 nuclear plants and ask operators for details about how they plan to resolve the problem. We plan to resolve the problem by studying it? Okay, good. The amount of money set aside for dismantling the plants has decreased at 4 out of every 5 reactors, according to an AP analysis of the financial records. The government could force plant operators to set aside more money, but that would be big government. Plant owners say they have several ways to close the gap. In addition to idling the plants, the government could simply extend licenses to operate them longer. Of course, that would mean operating plants that weren't be supposed to be operating any longer because they're obsolete or, you know, otherwise in great shape. And investments could recover in the years to come. Industry officials say a 6% annual rate of return is a reasonable long-term goal. Ask Jim Cramer. Meantime, it's not just us. An international center that funds ex-Soviet weapons scientists to prevent their knowledge from falling into the hands of terrorists warns it faces steep budget cuts. Our center clearly has less funds available than 2 or 3 years ago, says Adrian Vandermeer, executive director of the Moscow-based International Science and Technology Center. He says the center still plays an important part in securing dangerous biological materials in Russia and the former Soviet Union. Nowadays, the world is so open that every action we take, whatever, wherever in the world, is relevant to preventing non-state actors, i.e. terrorists, from getting hold of these materials, he said. Okay, so. You know, when there's money trouble, the atom just gets even more magical, don't you think? And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
And why don't we just start with a big, fat, long one from our friend Dave.
It was a week ago tonight, and maybe you know about it, maybe you don't know about it, but there was a joke that I told. And I thought I was telling it about the older daughter being at Yankee Stadium. And it was kind of a coarse joke. There's no getting around it. But I never thought it was anybody other than the older daughter. And before the show, I checked to make sure, in fact, that she is of legal age, 18. Yeah. But the joke really, in and of itself, can't be defended. The next day, people are outraged. They're angry at me because they said, how could you make a lousy joke like that about the 14-year-old girl who was at the ball game? And I had honestly no idea that the 14-year-old girl, I had no idea that anybody was at the ball game except the governor, and I was told at the time that she was there with Rudy Giuliani. And that's right. And I really should have made the joke about Rudy. But I didn't. And now people are getting angry and they're saying, well, how can you say something like that about a 14-year-old girl? And what does that make you feel good to make these horrible jokes about a kid who's completely innocent, minding her own business? And turns out she was at the ball game. I had no idea she was there. So she's now at the ball game, and people think that I made the joke about her. But still, I'm wondering, well, what can I do to help people understand that I would never make a joke like this? I've never made jokes like this as long as we've been on the air, 30 long years, and you can't really be doing jokes like that. And I understand, of course, why people are upset. I would be upset myself. And then I was watching the Jim Lehrer NewsHour, and this commentator, the columnist Mark Shields, is talking about how I had made this indefensible joke about the 14-year-old girl. And I thought, oh, boy, now I'm beginning to understand what the problem is here. It's the perception rather than the intent. It doesn't make any difference what my intent was. It's the perception. And as they say about jokes, that if you have to explain the joke, it's not a very good joke. And my responsibility, I take full of blame for that. I told a bad joke. I told a joke that was beyond flawed, and my intent is completely meaningless compared to the perception. And since it was a joke I told, I feel that I need to do the right thing here and apologize for having told that joke. It's not your fault that it was misunderstood. It's my fault that it was misunderstood. Thank you. So I would like to apologize, especially to the two daughters involved, Bristol and Willow, and also to the governor and her family and everybody else who was outraged by the joke. I'm sorry about it, and I'll try to do better in the future. Thank you very much.
Yes, apologizing does make you stutter. And it's not just America. Here are two members of a comedy troupe in Australia.
We'd like to apologise for the sketch we created called the Make a Realistic Wish Foundation. We've just heard from the ABC that they're pulling the show for a couple of weeks, which is disappointing to us because we really wanted to keep making the show. We don't agree with the decision, but we do want to apologise anyway. The sketch was a very dark sketch. Clearly too dark, and we acknowledge the pain and the hurt that it's caused to a lot of people, and we're really sorry for that.
Yeah, many people have asked how could we put a sketch like that to air, and in hindsight we realise we really did get it wrong. We never intended it to be taken literally, and we really never intended to say that sick kids were greedy or that the Make-A-Wish Foundation does anything other than good work. It was meant to be so over the top that people wouldn't take it seriously, but we got it wrong and we didn't convey that properly, and we take full responsibility for that.
Yeah, now that we've seen the impact of the sketch, we realise that there was nothing that could have justified the pain and anger that it's caused to people who have already suffered so much pain already. We got it wrong, we're really sorry for that, and we apologise.
So apparently apologising doesn't require stuttering. The Senate unanimously passed a resolution this week apologising for slavery, ladies and gentlemen, making way for a joint congressional resolution and the latest attempt by the federal government to take responsibility for 2.5 centuries of the practice. You wonder why we didn't do it 100 years ago, says Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa. It's important to have a collective response to a collective injustice. Peculiar institution, that's the phrase I was looking for. That's what they used to call it down south. The Senate's apology follows a similar apology passed last year by the House. One key difference is that the Senate version explicitly deals with the long-simmering issue of whether slavery descendants are entitled to reparations, saying that the resolution cannot be used in support of claims for restitution. The House is expected to revisit that issue next week. And that's right, the resolution will not be televised. The infamous apology phone call between Spencer Pratt and Lauren Conrad on MTV's The Hills. Do you know anything about this? No, it's completely made up. I think that's all we need to say about that. Didn't actually happen. Of course, you didn't know it happened, so now you didn't know that it didn't happen. South Carolina Republican leaders say they don't think online racist jokes by party activists will have a long-term impact on the party's ability to attract black voters and Democrats. Twice this week, Republican activists have apologized for racist humor. Wednesday, flanked by members of the NAACP, Columbia GOP activist Rusty DePass. I just read him. Rusty DePass apologized for the Facebook remark that likened First Lady Michelle Obama's ancestors to an escaped Riverbank Zoo gorilla. On Tuesday, Mike Green, an employee with the Lexington GOP consulting firm Starboard Communications, apologized for an online joke about President Barack Obama taxing aspirin, quote, because it's white and it works. Dateline Brasilia. The Brazilian government has apologized for the torture and abuse of 44 poor farmers under the military regime that ruled the country from 1964 to 1985 and announced reparations for the victims. What kind of a country are they running down there? Let's get Dick Cheney down there to tell him how you act when you torture. In the early 1970s, the farmers were physically tortured and many had their homes and crops destroyed by soldiers seeking information on guerrillas operating in a remote region in the northern jungle state of Pará. The Justice Ministry announced this week that the 44 farmers will receive up to 142,000 reals. That's about $71,000 American. That's more than we pay for a dead Afghan. And a lifelong pension of 2 minimum wages a month, currently worth about $465 American. This is a formal request for forgiveness by the Brazilian government, said the justice minister. This is recognition that not only were leftist militants affected by repression, but also untold other Brazilians. Unlike Argentina and Chile, Brazil never prosecuted members of the armed forces for human rights abuses committed under its dictatorship. An amnesty law pardoned all Brazilians, civilian and military, for alleged crimes committed under the dictatorship. Last year, a government study concluded there were 475 cases of people being killed or being disappeared at the hands of security forces during the military regime. Dateline Glendale, California, the Armenian National Committee Western Region, joined by community organizations and activists, met with KFI AM radio show host Bill Handel and station management regarding offensive comments that aired on Handel's radio show in May during a discussion between Handel and his board operator. Acknowledging that a line had been crossed, Handel, KFI, and the Clear Channel management, apologized to the Armenian-American community. With Handel himself being a descendant of Holocaust survivors, he also made it clear that recognition of the Armenian genocide is something he has been passionate about throughout his career. We deeply regret the inappropriate comments that were made on Bill Handel's show last month, which deeply hurt the Armenian-American community. The comments were wrong. They weren't deeply wrong. Use deeply in every sentence, why don't you? Robin Bertolucci, KFI program director. We take responsibility for this offense. KFI issued an on-air apology on June 12th at 6:30 a.m. I missed that. It also released a video apology from the board operator and the host of the broadcast. Dateline New Boston, Texas. A judge has declared a mistrial in a murder case after one of the defense attorneys was arrested on his way to court on suspicion of driving while intoxicated. Attorney Brian Simmons was taken into custody after a car wreck near New Boston, Texas. He denies being under the influence of alcohol, saying he lost control of his car during a sneezing fit brought on by allergies. He apologized to the court, his law partner, his client, and the murder victim's family. Well, it's a kind of seizure, a sneezing fit. I can understand that being a plausible excuse, even if it's not accurate. And I don't know. I wasn't there. I have no way of knowing. Ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week, a copyrighted feature of the broadcast, as is news from outside the bubble. Deadline Rome, this is the Reuters news service reporting that Muammar Gaddafi says the world had not rewarded Libya for giving up its ambition to have weapons of mass destruction. We cannot accept living in the shadow of intercontinental missiles and nuclear weapons, which is why we decided to change route, the Libyan leader told Italian senators. We had hoped Libya would be an example to other countries, but we have not been rewarded by the world. Italy, which last year apologized for Italian atrocities during its colonial rule of Libya, hey, we missed that, is at the forefront of the diplomatic thaw with Libya. Now gets a quarter of its oil from that country. But Gaddafi retains a defiant tone. He said, Iraq was a fortress against terrorism with Saddam Hussein. Al-Qaeda could not get in, but now thanks to the United States, it is an open arena and this benefits Al-Qaeda. Apparently, Gaddafi may think he was promised something. Much like the Awakening Councils. And from the Independent in London, you know, the British government is planning to hold an inquiry into the Iraq War. True. They're so backward there. Anyway, the debate has been whether it should be held in public or not. Imagine that. Now comes news. The row over the decision to hold the Iraq War inquiry behind closed doors escalated as it emerged that Tony Blair pressed current Prime Minister Gordon Brown to keep the inquiry private. In a move that will deepen the outrage of families of British soldiers killed in Iraq, the former Prime Minister, one of the architects of the controversial war, wanted the hearings to be held in secret to avoid a public and media circus. A public appearance by Blair before the inquiry, the Chilcot inquiry it's called, would also damage his ambitions of becoming president of the European Union, a role that needs the support of European countries, that opposed the war. Last Monday, Prime Minister Gordon Brown announced the long-awaited inquiry into the war in an attempt to shore up his premiership. But he immediately caused anger by revealing that the inquiry would be held in private. He performed a partial U-turn on Thursday by agreeing to some public sessions, although the hearings will still be mainly behind closed doors. And it's emerged that Blair intervened to influence Brown's decision. It's understood Blair did not ask Brown directly, but through intermediaries. The Prime Minister had considered holding it in public, according to Downing Street sources. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And the media are full of reports, of course, about the Twittering, the Facebook entries, the other online media posts coming from Iran in the wake of all of the events there over the past week. And there are some authorities, some scholars of the internet world who point to the fact that the Iranians may well be engaging in some disinformation, unable to close off all of the internet routes. They may be, in fact, having some people who either work for the government or are just supporters of Ahmadinejad sending posts of their own. One of the such authorities, a Canadian professor who studies internet information issues, says the chief practitioner of this policy right now is China, which has these approved hackers, so-called, 50 centers, they're called, because they're paid per post 50 cents, to pretend that they're independent folks who just happen to love what the Chinese government is doing as they post to various social networking sites. It sounds so Chinese, doesn't it? Until you get to this. John Donnelly, who until recently ran NOLA.com, the website that covers news in New Orleans, and also has an open comment forum, has now submitted an affidavit detailing a 3-year pattern of attacks on critics of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for its role in the flooding of New Orleans, which Donnelly investigated after a while and found out those attacks all came from computers residing in the offices of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He writes, "During my tenure as founding editor of NOLA.com, my duties included management and oversight of an aggressive program of community engagement features. I began observing a group about 20 user aliases deriding any story or user comment questioning the Corps' performance in protecting New Orleans from flooding. These comments tracked Corps talking points and media statements, often almost verbatim. Comments were often abusive and at times reached the level of harassment. I learned in mid-2008 that the internet address associated with these postings belonged to the New Orleans office of the Corps of Engineers. At that point, I watched the postings more closely. The Corps later admitted that posts were being made from within its network, but described them as an isolated event. In the latest response, Corps representative said any postings were made by people on breaks. This was clearly not the case, writes Donnellan. At the height of this wave of postings against Corps critics, I observed dozens of comments a day, normally made within minutes of a critical post. This indicated that the blogs and forums were being continually monitored inside the Corps, and postings were distributed throughout shifts. It would have been, in fact, a full-time job for one or more people to have conducted this activity. Even after the Corps commander said the issue had been addressed, the activity continued. But what crystallized the issue for me, Donnellan continues to write, was the news about the multi-million-dollar public relations campaign whose launch tracked the beginning of the attacks on critics of the Corps on NOLA.com. The public relations firm Outreach Process Partners bragged on its website that it had influenced the coverage of the Corps by major news organizations. I know that the use of covert postings is a recognized, if somewhat crude, tactic by many public relations campaigns. Red flags went off. If I were still in New Orleans in the context of this information about the public relations contact, I would be investigating the heck out of this," he writes. Sounds Sounds so Chinese.
I am a lonesome hombre. I spend my time driving my truck around town on Saturday. I moved here from the city. I thought that maybe all of my luck would change here in Boomtown. But it seems my face is wrong. I don't fit in, 'cause I don't have cowboy lips. My snakeskin boots and my belt buckle shine, but they don't talk to me. Even when I know their song, I'm in the wrong key. 'Cause I don't have cowboy lips. Cowboy lips are all right. Cowboy lips are all right. Give me cowboy lips. Cowboy lips are all right. Cowboy lips are all right. Give me cowboy lips. Cowboy lips. When I'm out honky-tonking, I smoke my Marlboros with the filters off. It makes me cough. Well, I can stomach Lone Star beer, but not shots of rye. Rye can only get by cowboy lips. Cowboy lips. Cowboy lips are all right. Give me cowboy lips.
Yo, let's go. Round of them.
Cowboy lips are all right. Give me cowboy lips. Cowboy lips are alright. Give me cowboy lips. Cowboy lips are alright. Give me cowboy lips. Cowboy lips are
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is Up to Here. Up to Here, a daily once-over not-so-lightly on the story at the top of what's behind today's news. I'm Milton Getzler in Washington. In the week of last week's presidential election, Iran has entered a period of instability not seen in that country since the revolution that toppled the Shah in 1979. The Shah, of course, remained toppled until his death. But this week, after what opponents say was a rigged or stolen election, news of demonstrations and street protests have spread worldwide through Facebook and Twitter. And of course, CPR's own Middle East Bureau Chief, Jessica Spiegel-Cheeks, continues to monitor the situation from her post here in Washington. President Obama has been attempting to walk a tightrope, not wanting to appear to meddle in another country's politics, while also wanting to meddle in Iranian politics. If we were talking about just another country, we wouldn't even be talking about it. But of course, in the aftermath of a war which weakened its chief adversary in the Middle East balance of power, whatever happens in Iran has significance for Americans at the pump and in the pocketbook. And so our guest today is joining us not so much for his expertise on Iran or the Middle East,
but for his expertise in the field of disputed elections. Former Vice President Al Gore, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you, Milton. I only wish my current TV had studios as nice as these.
Well, may a Burger Queen die and leave you in her will.
Oh, thanks.
Mr. Vice President, as you've sat and watched developments in Iran this week, how do you think the opposition has handled the situation?
Well, Milton, obviously the candidate who supposedly lost the election, Mr. Mousavi, has a very challenging role to play right now. He's a member of the establishment. He's not a rabble-rouser, but he also has to answer to millions of supporters. He can't just, you know, fade into the background now and grow a beard.
Especially since he already has one.
Exactly. Frankly, if I were him, I'd gather around me some really accomplished legal advisors who, you know, can walk him through the steps needed to appeal this election result. You know, they've got a very complicated system there with a parliament and the Guardian Council and so forth, and clearly that's not something a layman can pick his way through.
You mentioned the Guardian Council. Mm-hmm. What do you make of their offer to recount a random 10% of the votes in this election?
Well, of course, I have had some experience in that regard. I would tend to lean on the side of asking that all the votes be recounted. Now, of course, there's a fear on the part of the opposition that a lot of ballots may already have been destroyed. So then you have to look at some kind of a waiting system.
Waiting, as in not doing the recount right away?
No. You want it done as quickly as possible before people start thinking of you as a sore loser, you know, Norm Coleman type of character. But you do want to see if you can get a waiting kind of arrangement to compensate for possible ballot destruction. You wouldn't want to, you know, count certain ballots twice or anything, but you might want to count the votes in Mr. Mousavi's, let's say, his four most favorable districts first, so that if the recount were stopped at some point, you'd at least have those votes recounted fully.
And the value of that would be?
Oh, it would have an incalculably major impact on world opinion, which in a situation like this is what you want.
What about the pro-Ahmadinejad demonstrations? Do you think they're a spontaneous expression of support for the man, or is this part of something manufactured and manipulated?
I don't know for a fact, Milton, although I have seen some reports that these are Ahmadinejad operatives who've been sent out into the streets either to make trouble or make news, or both. But again, this is where really good legal advice becomes so important, because you can sue to find out.
Is that likely to be successful in revolutionary Iran?
Well, you know, you're spending campaign cash. You either spend it or you eat it. It's not like you can divert it to current TV or something.
You mentioned Norm Coleman. Mm-hmm. Are there any lessons for Mr. Mousavi in the way supposed Senator-elect Al Franken has been handling himself during the months of court wrangling that have followed that election?
Well, one thing is I'd say Al has been very well advised not to do any public joking during this period. It would have detracted from the gravitas that's necessary in this kind of situation. He doesn't tend to get that many laughs anyway. I would think Mr. Mousavi would be following very similar advice at this time.
Finally, sir, on another subject, I know you've kept relatively quiet on the matter of the two women from your TV channel who've been sentenced to 12 years by the North Korean government. Is there anything new you can tell us today?
Nothing about their situation, of course. We're monitoring developments, but basically we're doing what the administration asks us to do to not make their job any harder. I can tell you this, though, Milton. The programming pods, as we call them, that were going to have been filled with the reports from North Korea, instead they're going to be programmed with exciting new content generated by one of our viewers, a six-part series on how to build hemp furniture. Very cool stuff.
Mr. Vice President, thank you for giving us the benefit of your experience on this turbulent time in Iran.
Oh, my pleasure, Milton. Don't forget, count all the votes.
And up to now, you're up to here. We had help today from the Argent Foundation, helping public radio build new studios while laying off staff. and from the John T. and Catherine L. Nachtman Foundation for coverage of items of interest to Catherine. I'm Milton Getzler. Join us next time. We get you up to speed, up to here. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
This is the show. And time now to enter that very scary place. No.
High def, low def, no def, take my hand.
The digital wonderland.
It's a digital wonderland. Got to be so careful where you stand in the digital wonderland.
All right, it's week two. The story's, of course, fallen out of the news. But here's what's come in to the Show Dome this week. From Bob, Dear Harry, here in hilly, forested Northern California, we've always had trouble receiving over-the-air television. I was able to receive four over-the-air stations, two perfectly, with an elaborate antenna system and rotor. I hold an FCC technician license and have spent my life in radio and television, but despite my best efforts, I will never receive DTV because of, as the FCC puts it, trees and terrain. If you don't have a direct line of sight to the TV towers, you will not receive DTV. But that's not the item. I was in communication with the FCC in December when I first discovered my absolute lack of digital TV signals. In response to my technical questions and a review of all that I'd done to receive digital TV, I received the following. Dear sir, you can always use a radio, unquote. All right. It's true. Another technically expert person writes in and begins his missive with, please do not use my name. All right, I won't. Harry, I'm an engineer for a major broadcaster in New York City and was in the room when they threw the switch on June 12th for the digital changeover. Within minutes, the phone lines were overloaded. By the end of the weekend, the overflow calls filled multiple voicemail accounts. 1 week later, we are still hundreds of calls behind. The vast majority of calls came from the elderly, the poor, and immigrants. I should not have been surprised. After all, anyone who can afford cable would not notice anything had happened. Within a few hours, a pattern emerged. Most of the difficulties were antenna-related. Over and over, we instructed the callers to purchase a new antenna. This is no simple task for an 85-year-old with difficulty walking and limited funds, and a new antenna is still no guarantee they will pick up signals in a New York City apartment. For those who live far from the city, their rooftop antennas were inadequate as well. Their choice is to spend hundreds installing a new antenna or subscribe to cable. Besides the transmission to digital, the frequencies were swapped and transmitter power was reduced. It's not what we were told was going to happen. The local stations in New York City have already requested a waiver from the FCC to increase power. In closing, Le Show is the only place where these problems are being discussed. Take care. Don't use my name. Boy, is that a temptation. Mike writes, I can use Mike's name. Dear Harry, they keep on making digital TV worse. I work in television doing video color grading and mastering, so I'm not hallucinating. I am an unfortunate subscriber to DirecTV. The quality of the broadcast has always been bad compared to over-the-air analog TV. But it was digital. But this past week, the digital broadcast on DirecTV got much worse, exhibiting significant increase in compression artifacts. I suspect that as DirecTV pushes more and more channels over their satellites, they've run out of bandwidth, so they're resorting to crushing the quality of each channel. Thanks for continuing to shine a light on the charade of better television through digitization. Jill writes, Dear Harry, I've heard you do news segments about the digital TV switch. I bought two converter boxes a long time ago with coupons, but now they're basically useless because I lost almost all of my channels. After Friday the 12th, I went online expecting to see stories about upset people, but all the coverage I saw announced a huge success. Imagine that. I live alone and don't earn a lot, and it blows that I'm forced to get cable to watch The Bachelorette. Love your show. She wants to watch The Bachelorette. She's an American citizen. It's her right. The FCC says it will now be sending engineers to Baltimore, Nashville, Raleigh, North Carolina, Rochester, New York, Miami, and Richmond, Virginia to help stations who have asked it for assistance either with DTV consumer outreach or technical issues with signal reception. This according to Broadcasting and Cable magazine. It already has boots on the ground in Chicago, Philadelphia, New York to help with digital transition issues there. Rochester has two stations with trouble, and all the other cities, just one. The situation remains fluid, says Broadcasting and Cable, with some of those stations potentially coming off the list as rescanning or antenna positioning take care of much of the problem, and others possibly added as issues arise. In the case of former UHF stations that have switched to VHF, only to find they lack the power to penetrate buildings in some urban areas, the FCC has already helped by granting power increases. Dan writes, Harry, just when I thought you'd been pulling a Y2K on us, or maybe a Chicken Little, I had my first experience of the digital wonderland, watching a ball game on a rainy Saturday afternoon when we experienced a momentary loss of power, 5-10 seconds at the most. When the power came back, the TV picture didn't. That's not quite right. We had a frozen picture, and where there had been motion, there was some flickering, a batter standing motionless, the bat flickering like a fan. That's it. Nothing else going on. No sound. I know baseball can be slow, but not that slow. Thanks to you, I didn't whack the side of the TV. I left it on like a 3D painting to come and drop you a line. KTVB in Boise reports it's received approximately 1,300 phone calls in 3 days from viewers unable to reach it or to receive it. In most cases, the caller has not rescanned for new channel. The majority of the callers are 65-plus. This Boise television station recommends double rescanning. In some cases where stations move their digital frequencies, simple scanning may not be enough. There's a procedure sometimes called double rescanning that can clear your box's memory of saved channels. These earlier scans may have saved channel information that is now incorrect. Disconnect the antenna from the box or digital TV. Rescan the box or digital TV without the antenna connected. Unplug the box or digital TV from the electrical outlet for at least 1 minute. Reconnect the antenna to the box or digital TV and plug the unit into the electrical outlet. Rescan the box or digital TV one more time. Oh, by the way, you must have a VHF-UHF antenna. Rescan often, says Nick Swan of Nick's Radio and Electronics in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Anytime your antenna moves, you have to rescan your channels to make sure they're still there. It's rescanning, ladies and gentlemen. It's fun, isn't it? It's a digital wonderland. And now...
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an
inspector general. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, inspectors general are getting into the news more and more. A federal thrift regulator bungled its oversight of Downey Savings and Loan, allowing the Newport Beach institution to pile on billions of dollars in high-risk mortgages and eventually collapse. This is according to the Treasury Department's inspector general. The regulators from the Office of Thrift Supervision, according to the IG, also botched their oversight of Pomona-based PFF Bank and Trust, which collapsed along with Downey last fall. The Obama administration has proposed that the OTS be abolished as part of its overhaul of financial regulation. A government audit found the State Department overpaid the contract security firm once known as Blackwater by tens of millions of dollars because the company failed to properly staff its teams in Iraq. The report didn't identify any specific security breaches, but it said the State Department should have withheld at least $55 million in payments to the company because of the shortfalls. The audit by the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction and the State Department's Inspector General said Blackwater didn't employ enough guards, medics, marksmen, and dog handlers to fully man the teams, which were responsible just for protecting the U.S. ambassador and other high-level officials. The failure to consistently field the right numbers of guards endangered the U.S. officials whom the company was being paid to protect, according to the report. The audit also found that Blackwater, which this year changed its name to sometimes overcharged for airfare to and from Iraq, and failed to properly account for some equipment received from the U.S. government. A company spokeswoman said it had been fully compliant with the terms and conditions of the contract. The Special Inspector General charged with overseeing the $700 billion bailout of the financial sector says he's been told by the Treasury Department of the Obama administration that the Treasury Department has legal authority over his office, a claim that could threaten its independence. Neil Barofsky says the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel is being asked to sort out the issue. Good news, John Yoo doesn't work there anymore. Barofsky is unsure why the dispute arose and is concerned that it could threaten the independence of his office. The Inspector General of Amtrak unexpectedly resigned Thursday night, becoming the third such federal official to leave prematurely since the Obama administration took office. the latest in a string of potentially controversial moves involving government watchdogs. Fred E. Weiderhold, a 30-year veteran of the agency who was responsible for rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse, is the most high-profile change among the group of senior government officials who have responsibility to conduct independent investigations. He's been replaced by an acting inspector general. The spokesman said only that Weiderhold retired, but several officials who asked not to be identified raised questions about the development, which set off alarm bells among some close Amtrak watchers. This comes after the inspector general of the Corporation for National Community Service was fired last week by the Obama administration. That's a messy little case involving Sacramento mayor and former Phoenix point guard Kevin Johnson. And the inspector general of the International Trade Commission was told her contract would not be renewed. News of the Inspector General, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. It all sounds so Chinese, doesn't it? That's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, on the internet, if it's still working in your country, at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available on your smartphone via Stitcher.com, available as a free download to members at www.audible.com/LeShow, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like being able to apologize without stuttering if you'd agree to join with me then, all right? Would you? Thank you very much. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast and playlist of music heard here on always available at the ever-evolving harryshearer.com. Next week, a special broadcast from London and Washington. Huh? Yeah. Have to hear it. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. This is subscriber-supported 89.9 KCRW Santa Monica, KCRI Indio Palm Springs, KCRU Oxnard Ventura, KCRY Mojave Antelope Valley, KCRW is NPR News and independent music, streaming and podcasting at KCRW.com. We're a community service of Santa Monica College.